Welcome to the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast. Conversations focused on how some of the world's top energy leaders are innovating to deliver clean, affordable, and reliable energy for the future. Your hosts are energy and climate expert, Dr. Andrew Parker, and midstream industry veteran, Adam Murray. Now, here are Andrew and Adam.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast, where we dive deep into some energy sector conversation. I'm really trying to talk about education and learning throughout the sector. We have a really good show today. Andrew, how you doing?
I'm good, Adam. How are you?
Ready for the weekend, to put a timestamp on it. Yeah, it's Friday.
I feel you there, man. Well, look, I'm excited for today's episode. We're talking to a friend of mine and a board member that I work with. So welcome in Jessica Laramie. Jessica, how are you?
I'm doing great, Adam and Andrew. Thanks for having me today. Adam, I'm feeling the sentiment. Ready for the weekend. Yeah.
I had planned to do this from my office because I've got the lame, you guys all have cool backgrounds and Adam's got the cool picture behind him. And at least since the last time we filmed, Adam, I did get a new orchid. So, you know, I mean,
it's alive. Good.
It's alive this time. So that's good. So Jessica, I'm going to start off with our Let's Clear the Air icebreaker. And you live in a ski town here in Colorado. You lucky duck, you. And so I'm going to ask, because I've always wondered, is it better to live in a Colorado ski town in the winter or the summertime?
Oh, I will go summer every time. I know I live in a ski town, but summer is so beautiful. The weather and hiking. And I think like just activity outside for me in my, let's like call it more advancing age, is a little bit less risky activities. So I enjoy downhill skiing, but I love fishing. I love hiking. I love riding my bike. And being able to do that up here in the summertime and, you know, driving my bike through wildflower paths and trails in the summer, nothing beats it.
So is it less crowded in the summer than in the winter, or is it equally as crowded?
I would equally or more.
Wow, really?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. That's, it's surprising. Wild. I know it's really surprising. Yeah. But I would say it's just as busy, if not more. We get a really big draw 4th of July and some of the summer holidays.
I think everyone romanticizes living in the Colorado high country in the wintertime, but I think it would get old. So Adam, if you could live in the ski country, what season would you pick?
Oh, I'm not a skier. My knees won't take it. You know, I'm built for comfort, not for speed. So golfing, I've golfed up in Vail, Breckenridge, and a few other places, and you can certainly drive the golf ball about 50 yards further out there. So I gotta go right. Summer as well.
It's true, man. I played golf in Houston a few months ago, and I was really disappointed that my drives weren't going as far as they normally do in Colorado. You know, I thought I could drive at 300, but I can't drive at 300 at sea level, I learned. So, well, cool. Well, look, Jessica, we appreciate the time to talk to us today. And I think all of our listeners are going to really enjoy your perspectives because you have some really interesting perspectives, having worked running an energy management program at a university here in Colorado for many years. And you have some interesting perspectives to share. But before we jump into that, you're a partner at Chanard Franklin. And so maybe just spend a few minutes sharing a little bit about your background and your story and energy.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I would say much like many of us, my path hasn't necessarily been linear in the energy industry. So, you know, I started working for oil and gas companies out of Denver in land administration and land-based roles. I worked for, you know, some of the larger independents out of Denver, and then went back to law school. So I had gone to grad school in Denver, started working in industry, and then went back to law school while I was working within the industry. And after I graduated law school, I started picking up some part-time teaching, just carrying forward some of the things I was learning within the industry, within my program, and trying to, I guess, just share a little bit more about my experience and some of the skills I was picking up and how it related to what I was doing in school. And so through that experience, I really like picked up a passion for teaching and working with students and really workforce development for energy and oil and gas. That was something that I really loved doing. And, you know, I would picked up some trainings within our companies and doing presentations or some cross-disciplinary, how do we get everybody on board with the same processes? And through that, I sort of fell into teaching when this opportunity opened up for a full-time position and decided to jump into teaching full-time. And I spent about 9 years in higher education teaching at the undergraduate level. And then now I'm back in the private sector, back in industry, like you said, Andrew, as an attorney with Shainer & Franklin, doing energy, oil and gas, and, you know, just helping companies and clients get their projects done.
And so I think the goal of this podcast was to talk a little bit about your experiences in higher education, running, you know, a program that was focused on energy. So maybe start there with, you know, a little bit about the program that you were running and what kind of the whole big picture of the program.
Yeah. So the program itself is an undergraduate program. There's about 10 similar undergraduate programs across the United States. You know, it kind of varies, dropping down as low as 8, as high as 12 to 15 at points in time. And there's a couple graduate programs that are all accredited by the same body. And it's really geared towards practical skill development for placing students within roles in energy and oil and gas. And so when I first started working for the program, it was, you know, very specific and focused as far as land-based work and very specific and focused as far as oil and gas. So it was primarily land roles within oil and gas. Throughout the years, it broadened quite a bit, never abandoning its roots in oil and gas or in land work, but expanding that skill development a little bit more beyond, you know, beyond oil and gas into more emerging technologies and energy development, carbon sequestration.
Yeah. Land can apply to anything, right? I mean, you need land for wind or solar or whatever else you're doing, right?
Yeah. I mean, my point that I would always share with students was like, hey, if we're developing natural resources, they're fixed to the land, or you've got to fix something to the land to harness them in some way, right? You've got to use land in some way, shape, or form. And so it's absolutely essential and integral that we understand that process. We understand the rights. We understand the law around it. We understand the impacts of using it if we want to do it right and we want to do it well.
You've had to evolve over the course of the time that you were there. I mean, was that a significant challenge to you, or did you see, you know, that it was kind of easy with the new generation of folks coming in?
I would say the evolution that I experienced, it was challenging at times. It was not easy to, you know, look at what you were doing and see that maybe it's not relevant anymore and that it's not working and it's not effective. But I think that in some ways, the way that the educational system and some of these programs were traditionally approaching it just weren't working. It wasn't appealing to the next generation. It wasn't helping develop workforce. And it was lacking in some of that core development to help students have a longer term successful career. And that core development sometimes was more around the soft skills, not necessarily, you know, the hard technical skills that we were focusing on. So that was a challenge, right? And it was humbling to be in that position, to have to, you know, reflect and look at what you're doing and say, this isn't working, and how do I get better, and what can I do better?
What was the background of the faculty members that were teaching in the program, and were they from industry, or were they the traditional academics?
A mix. So the program had a core base curriculum built out of business curriculum and built within a school business. So with that, there were quite a few academics, but also some practitioners that were teaching as adjuncts. And the academics were, you know, primarily focused around accounting and economics and finance. And then with our energy specific content, so as you started to get more into the skill development required to be placed in industry, that was more practitioners and folks that had either were actively working within the industry and teaching as adjuncts, or had come in, had some industry experience, and were carrying those skills that they had utilized in the workforce back into the classroom.
Outside of the department, similar question, how did the colleagues and those other students kind of perceive the energy management department?
You know, I would say that evolved over time with some of the changes that we made internally. You know, when I first started, I think there was a lot of negative reputation around what we were doing. And, you know, some of that was founded and some of it was not founded. Some of it was assumptions that had been drawn or judgments that were made on the surface of what we were doing. That was really hard at times because, you know, the students who were doing these amazing things, who were working towards progress, who are working towards developing skills, who want to learn, who want more, were treated in ways that didn't feel good to see other people treated. And I think it took a long time. You know, it's not just changing what you're doing and changing the contents and the makeup of what we were doing that solved that problem, but you have to build the relationships and you had to have the hard conversations and you had to talk about what you were doing. And so for me, it was like, you know, maybe it wasn't received well. And I saw that. And initially, my response was to withdraw, right? I was like, well, they just don't get what I'm doing. I'm just going to put my head down and work. I'm going to do my job. I'll get stuff done. And that wasn't fair to the students in the program. And it wasn't fair to minimize their successes and their accomplishments by not sharing that with everyone. And so, you know, I had to make a conscious decision to react and change my behavior in a way that was more outward facing, which was hard to do because I'm an introvert and I like, cool, I just want to like put my head down and do my job. But I had to share and I had to get involved and I had to have like way more coffees and lunches and happy hours than my introverted self ever thought I would be signing up for. But I had to build those relationships. And once those relationships were built across departments, across function, across discipline, across ideologies even, the acceptance came. And the more we highlighted the positive of what we were doing, the more we were able to talk about the good, the more we were able to share, the more productive conversations we had. And I think more the perspective and the reputation changed.
Was it easier to change the minds of the faculty members or the students?
Oh, that's a tough question. I would say both had their challenges. And it's not about changing minds, right? Like, I'm not here to change people's minds. I'm here to share like my understanding of what's going on here and my perspective and what I think is happening. I'm here to share a way to think about things, but I'm not here to tell you how to think. Right. And so through developing those ways, like those relationships, then build trust. And then when you have that trust, then you can talk about different ways to think about things. You know, for the students, I would say like the student mentality and the student perspective is very different than the faculty mentality and the faculty perspective. So when you're talking about students, you know, I can't change the fact that some of them have spent the first, maybe not the first 18 years of their life, but maybe the last 10 years of their lives, very worried and incredibly panicked and having a lot of anxiety around climate. And so it's talking through that and acknowledging it and acknowledging their fear and their positioning and then sharing ways to think about climate that might be different than what they've heard before. You know, at the faculty level, It can be really, really hard to go against the grain, right? For a lot of different reasons. But, you know, at many academic institutions, resources get allocated based on how many seats or how many students you have in the classroom. And so to fill your classes, you have to appeal to the masses. And to appeal to the masses, you have to speak to what the masses want. And so if polarization or extremes or fear or anti-development or anti-anything is selling, then you're going to start to see more of that rhetoric and you're going to start to see more of that programming in higher education. But one of the most amazing transformations that I've seen over the last couple of years is that, you know, there was a big shift in what the masses being the students and the consumer and the client of our product, wanted. And, you know, I had this great conversation just a few years ago with a student, and she was using her Gen Z lingo. And she's like, you know, I think what she said was polarization is basic. You know, that was like her Gen Z term. And I'm like, well, okay, wait, got to remember, like, go deep and remember what that actually means. Polarization is basic. And I've unfollowed everybody on social that has extreme viewpoints. And at that moment in time, I was like, we've arrived. Like, we've arrived. We are ready for progress. The rest of the class was like completely on board with her statement, agreed with what she was saying. Like, we're over it. We're done with polarization, standing on the sidelines shouting. And we want to be part of practical, reasonable solutions. And when the students are calling for that, the faculty have no choice but to adapt, right? And give them ways to engage positively and ways to engage effectively. And that's driven by the students and the consumer, right? So it's not me changing minds or telling people how to think or, you know, changing how somebody thinks. It's the students and the faculty, like, kind of going through that experience together and one responding to the other and saying, like, hey, it's time. We're ready for it. We're here. We'll show up if you give it to us. And that was amazing. Like, that transformation over the last, I don't know, 5 years or so has been, I mean, it's why I kept going with it.
That was an awesome answer. Like, that was so great. That was so... Like, that was why I wanted to have this conversation today. Was that was such an awesome.
It just seems like such a tall task, reaching so many people that, you know, might not even be in the program, right? You look, you know, from the outside in and you're like, oh man, those, you know, I can imagine that it happens the same at petroleum engineering kind of operations at different universities throughout the country. And, you know, how was that? I mean, did you feel like you were trying to go above and beyond in your role, or was that just kind of part of the process in order to get your, you know, engineering management piece kind of into?
You know, the soft skill development that came out of my role, like my time in this role, is unlike anything I've experienced at any other point in my career. The technical stuff I feel good about. The technical stuff I can share, the technical things I can talk about, like, this is my home base, I'm comfortable here. The patience and understanding and empathy, but communication and intentional messaging and self-awareness, that was far more challenging than anything I've ever done or any other role I've ever had. And I'm so grateful for that, because I wouldn't have had that development or that experience otherwise.
Without getting too into the details, I just have this one question. Like, are there any specific incidents or, you know, not necessarily combative situations or anything, but there are any specific situations that you can remember where there was really a lesson learned, or there was really a, ultimately both sides just really found a good conversation?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say, you know, it's hard to be pro oil and gas on a college campus. And at times there were, I can think of a couple instances where behavior wasn't positive. There were some negative behaviors. There was like really mean, unkind bullying, you know, from people that you wouldn't expect it from, or you would hope that, like, as society, we would be doing better. And I would say, you know, it's not unique to the graduate, undergraduate, higher education level. I mean, the anti-fossil fuel sentiment is so ingrained in education at all levels. I was in a program that actively taught energy, and that was its primary focus. But even where you have programs that aren't actively teaching energy, you see a lot of anti-fossil fuel rhetoric passively. I mean, you're passively teaching. There's a lot of passive teaching of anti-fossil fuel rhetoric. And, you know, sometimes I would have students come to me and they'd have, like, they're working on their English composition assignment and they've been asked to write a paper about why we should ban fracking in Colorado or why we should stop using all fossil fuels. And you're like, what? How did we get there in English? But this is where we're at. And so, like, let's talk about that and let's talk how you can positively engage and where you can find good information and where you can do this in a way that offers. Or how you can do this in a way that offers solutions without compromising yourself or what you think is right. And that's possible. You can do that. But, you know, a college campus is really like a microcosm of larger society. So all the challenges that you see happening at the local, state, national level, whether it's politics or polarization or media or ego or hate speech or whatever that is, right? That happens on a college campus too. And the great thing about a college campus is, like, that's your time to explore and figure out and find your people and find ways to navigate that before you move into the broader world. So what better a playground to, like, try to practice responding in a positive way or to figure out what it is that you think and what you believe and how you actually feel about something and what your opinions are. And navigate and practice ways to do that positively. And so, you know, as much as there were some nasty things that happened, you know, it was like an evolution, the same evolution that happened across the industry. It was like we went through the divestment thing, the pipelines, you know, like it was like divestment and then the pipelines, like Dakota Access and some of those other big issues hit. And we had all sorts of rallies and posters and things happening on campus. And every time something like that happened, I thought we were over divestment, but it, like, actually came back up again a couple months ago. And I was like, wait, we're here again? This is, like, still, but it is, right? It hadn't been fully addressed the first time. And every time that I saw something happened, I asked and invite, like, asked the people who were responsible for that behavior, responsible for that communication, or responsible for that email that went out to the whole campus, to talk to me. And I invited them in, or I offered to meet them at their space and had those hard conversations. And it, because it's easy to say those things and to do those things when you don't see the face.
Yeah.
But for me to sit down at a table with somebody and tell them that they've said that what I do doesn't matter, and what you've said, what I do doesn't belong here, and that what you said, that, like, what I do isn't important, and that the students that I work with aren't important and don't have a place here, that is not inclusive. That is not fostering diversity of thought. And that is, I don't think that's what we want to be as an institution or as a group or as a club or as a community, right?
I hope this is our most listened to podcast yet, because, like, this is such an awesome message, right? And, like, I've been in those shoes, and I remember, Jessica, you and I talking about this, you know, last year. And, you know, my own experience is I went from Boulder, Colorado to College Station, Texas. Can't get more culture shocked in the United States than that change. And I was not an oil and gas fan. I swore I'd never worked for the oil and gas industry. And then I was able to do some learning and wake up to the realities and see that there was actually core value alignment with what I wanted to do in my career and what I could do in energy. But your point 5-10 minutes ago about it's really hard to go against the grain. And when you've got funding tied to headcount ratings, right? Whether it's the media and advertising or headcount in the classroom on a college campus, like it's really hard to break that cycle. And the polarization just seems to perpetuate on that principle. But yet so many people I talk to aren't polarized. And yeah, I think people forget that a very small group of people occupy the collective majority of the conversations we're having, whether it's on LinkedIn or social media, whatever social media you follow. So what would your advice be to someone who is trying to have a conversation with someone across the table that they don't see eye to eye with? What are some of those soft skills that you developed that really helped
these
discussions?
That's a great question. I think my, you know, my approach, like I said at first, was to withdraw. And then I had to really dig deep to figure out, like, what do I need to do and what do I need to be effective here? And I think that took for me a lot of self-reflection and exploring my own relationship with energy and oil and gas in order to be able to share that with or others. So like at times it got maybe a little bit more philosophical than some people are comfortable with, but I had to go there to be effective. I had to make a conscious decision about how to react when I'm put in a box or judged or treated in a way that I felt like was unjustified or unfair. And I had to share and I had to make myself vulnerable. And so again, like that, those parts of my personality that were harder for me to draw from, I had to go there and I had to tell stories. I had to talk about experiences I've had. I had to, you know, be specific and say like, hey, I went through this. I saw this happen. I did this. But I ended up sharing a lot of stories. I shared a lot of stories in the classroom. I shared a lot of stories over coffee. I can't tell you how many times I said out loud that just because I support oil and gas doesn't mean that I'm also all of these other things. I had to humanize it. I had to talk about my journey. So Andrew, just like you shared with how you went from Boulder to Texas, I came to Colorado and studied environmental law and natural resources. And I spent my spring break in grad school planting trees on the Rio Grande. And I've had an incredibly fulfilling career in oil and gas, and I love it. I love my time in there. I love the people. I love the community. And, you know, I'm going to like draw from Tisha Shuler's, like both of these things can be true. I can be all those things. They're not like contrary to one another. They can coexist. And I got a lot of positive response when I shared that. I shared stories about like my time in my first job. You know, I showed up at my first job in Denver. I was 22 years old and I was asked to give a presentation about myself. So it's like, here, my name is Jessica and I went to school here and I studied this and here's where I grew up and here's how many people are in my family, right? Because I'm like talking about the things that I think are important. And they wanted to know, like the prompt at the time was, why are you here? And why does this matter to you? And why are you doing this job? And I went to this whole spiel about protecting natural resources and environmentalism to a group of people in an oil and gas company. And the response I got was like, wow, that's amazing. That's so cool. There's space for you here. We believe in that too. We'll help you get there. How can we help you? We want to help you see your dreams. We'll listen to you. And I was listened to. And so sharing stories like that went a really long way. Before I could share those stories, I had to listen, right? So active listening, I had to listen to what was, you know, why people thought the way they thought. I had to have hard conversations. I had to hear things, some things that like I didn't really want to hear. But you can get there with that, like with that dialogue, with the respectful active listening. You know, I talked about working in energy, working in oil and gas, and I talk about decarbonization and what that means in the industry and how that can exist as like a concept or a goal or a desire that people believe in and also still produce oil and gas.
I know, Adam, you have a question, but I just want to interject really quick. So just to piggyback off what you were saying, active listening, Jessica. So one book I've been reading as a shameful plug here, Surrounded by Idiots. And it's about the four types of human behavior, if you're familiar with the certain personality surveys. Anyway, it opens up chapter one, communication happens on the listener's terms. right? And so to your point, you know, I think learning how to communicate with people, understanding how they hear your message is an important part of actively listening. And then being able to articulate back in a way that they're going to hear you is really, really important. So sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Adam.
Oh, no, I just, you know, it sounds like you've had so many, you know, successes, and you were in that role for quite a while and remain in the energy business in a little different way. I was curious if you ever kept track or still run into any of the folks that have gone through that program, and, you know, if you kind of tracked if they stayed in the energy business or actually graduated, you know, started in energy management,
oh,
graduated
with energy. Yeah, so many of them. You know, the program that we were in was a small program, a small school. And, you know, like so many of us experience at that broader level within the energy industry and within the oil and gas industry, that sense of community that gets developed when you're in something with somebody together. So that sense of community at a college campus is just, it's innate to the college experience as you're learning and growing with people together. And so, yeah, I keep in touch with a lot of our former students. Many of them are still working within the industry. Many of them are having, you know, long, successful careers within the industry. And even, you know, upcoming students who are going through the program or thinking about going through the program, I still talk to, because it's like, you know, it's a family when you're working in this industry, and we support each other. You rely on each other. You turn to each other when you need that support. And, you know, that's one of the most amazing things about a college campus is that you go to college and you find your people, right? And hopefully many of us go to college and have that experience where we find our group, mm-hmm. and we find the club and we find the program and we find the things that make us feel like part of a community and part of a family. And I felt that a lot at my former institution. I felt that a lot in higher education. And that creates lifelong bonds and relationships, right?
Well, speaking of those, yes, bonds and those communities, you and Andrew share a few experiences as far as being on boards together and things like that, and classes you've gone through and whatnot. You guys want to talk about that as we run up on time?
Yeah, Jessica, go ahead. Tell everybody a little bit about what the NGEN program is all
about. Yeah, so the NGEN program through the Energy Leadership Institute is, that program is just a transformational leadership program focused on energy. It is cross-sector. It's multidisciplinary. It is national. It's developing skills and tools and relationships, so many of which I've drawn from, you know, from that program and my time learning through the leadership program, and brought back to my role, and has helped me be effective as an energy leader.
Yeah, I think the coolest part about NGEN is, you know, it's an energy agnostic group of emerging professionals in the energy world, right? So it's not just oil and gas. There's people from hydro and CCS, and, you know, once a month for a half day, there's a virtual seminar. And then once a quarter, we meet in person for 2 days, and you just get these different, you know, perspectives in the same room and start talking about, how are we going to collectively tackle the energy transition question? And it's crazy energizing. It's so much fun. And I think it gives you, it certainly gives me a lot of hope for the energy future, because we're going to be in good hands with a lot of the folks that are working on these questions.
Yeah, so. I couldn't agree more, Andrew.
If someone wanted to find out more or get involved or whatever, they call you guys, or who do they reach out?
Yeah, they can reach out to Jessica or I. You can go to the website. There's a contact, the Energy Leadership Institute.org. You can go there too and submit questions through there. It is a nonprofit and is generously supported by some fantastic sponsors. So certainly would love, if people want to get interested and involved with NGEN, to look it up, reach out to us, and we'll put you in contact with the right folks. Yeah.
Perfect. Any questions to wrap it up, Andrew?
No, Jessica? No, I think that's it. Jessica, I can't say thank you enough for coming on. This was, I'm passionate about having these conversations with people, and your perspective and just the insights that you had are just, this is one of my favorite episodes we've done. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing with us.
You bet. I'm happy to thank you for the platform. Really. I mean, if I can share one thing, it's that the next generation is showing up. They're showing up and they're ready for it. And it's time for us as, folks that have had time in the industry and have some expertise and knowledge, it's time for us to show up for them too. And there's plenty of ways we could do that.
That leads in right into our ending question. We typically ask the same question to wrap up every episode. And I hope certainly it's not 3 years before you have you on again, because I feel like we could talk for another hour about just your experiences, but it's 3 years. You're back on this show and you're happy. Things are going well. What has happened over the last 3 years that have caused you to be this way?
Oh, I think if I could say I'm super happy 3 years from now, more industry engagement and education. I think energy industry can connect the current workforce with students in a way that currently isn't happening and can lead to a lot of progress, maybe even, acceptance at some point in time, but progress. And most of us working in the industry support the industry because we're in it and we see so much value in it and we can tie it to a bigger purpose. But the rest of the world doesn't know that yet, right? Because they're not in it like we are. And so for a long time, the rhetoric was like, we just need to educate people about what we're doing. They just need to know. If they knew, they would accept it. It's so much deeper than that, right? It's not telling people the facts they already, that they don't already know, but it's about sharing those experiences and finding common ground and building relationships and community and telling your story and listening to other people's stories. And there's so many reasons why that education matters and that engagement and energy education matters. And I think it's more than just like a line on your ESG report, right? It's workforce development. It's, which we know is a significant issue right now in the energy industry, right? It's attracting good talent. It's knowledge transfer. It's awareness and understanding and information sharing, not in a here are the facts way, but in a like, let's get through this together way. And the industry, the energy industry, the oil and gas industry has the resources and the information and the tools to transform that. And I think there's a lot of different ways industry can engage in education, whether that's, you talking to your kids' classes about, going into the fifth grade class and talking about energy, or opening up your office or your field sites to a field trip for a class or a program. It's programming and help with curriculum development. It's mentoring students and supporting competitions and, serving as a judge for a competition or helping support a club, giving presentations, volunteering time, all of it. And we can do that, right? Like that's something that we can do. And I think if we do that over the next few years, then maybe in the long term, we've actually maybe progressed a little bit on this and we've educated in a meaningful and effective way. And we've moved the needle on acceptance through understanding and support, solving problems and making gains on decarbonization and achieving practical policy and regulation, right? All of that comes from that engagement at the educational level.
Well, what a good way to wrap it up. I mean, words to live by for the next 3 years,
right? Amen, right?
Challenge accepted.
At the road. It's funny hearing all that, how it ties in with a lot of our other episodes, right? Like Dr. Scott Tinker,
I was thinking of Tinker.
You mentioned Tisha and, a few other folks that do various different things. So I can't thank you enough. This has been an amazing episode. Thank you so much, Andrew. I look forward to talking to you here in the next episode, whenever we get that done here next
week. Yeah, next week. We got Liz O'Connell coming on from Aerolytics to share a little bit of the Canadian perspective on oil and gas. So that'll be a fun discussion.
Awesome. Little teaser there. And thank you to all our listeners. If you guys want to reach out to Andrew and I on LinkedIn, let us know what guests you want to hear from. Let us know what topics you want to talk about, and we can do our best to accommodate. But thank you, everybody, for joining the Let's Clear the Air podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast with Adam Murray and Dr. Andrew Parker. If you like what you have heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast at gmail.com.